morning, everyone. This is Jim Hansen, and we are recording this on October the 24th, 2023. It's roughly 9 a.m. in Birmingham, Alabama, where I am, and I think it's about 3 p.m. or maybe 4 p.m. In the location of our guest today, who's in France. I'm really honored to and excited to talk today with Noah Polipsky, a world-renowned golf instructor, golf professional, author, peripatetic worldwide golf traveler. Going to have a lot of interesting stories to hear from him. But I really want to focus a lot of the discussion today on what Noah does with his instruction, and that includes a book that he published back in 2015 entitled Peaceful Golf, A Journey into the Unknown. And I think I'm a very appropriate person to be interviewing him, because when it comes to peaceful golf, a journey to the unknown, it is really an unknown journey to me, because my journeys in golf don't usually take me to peaceful places. I mean, beautiful places, but in terms of my own internal approach to the game, I really need a lot of help to become more and more peaceful. So I want to get a lot of help from him. I mean, this is almost like a therapy session for me, whether he knows it or not. I want to say a little bit about his teaching approach and his philosophy of golf instruction, and what he means by peaceful golf. What he does in his book, which I just finished last night, should have read it a long time ago, he takes the reader on a journey that features his breakthrough approach to golf instruction, and which encourages golfers to abandon traditional methods and embrace the game with a much deeper understanding. Noah shows how to find true freedom through having an open, fluid mind and harnessing the subconscious. That's a cool thing to do, I think, if I can find out how to do it. Though some liken him to a philosopher or a guru, and I'm almost tempted to liken him to that, Noah sees himself more as a truth seeker. He asks golfers to think for themselves, and he offers an approach based on the fundamentals of freedom, creativity, and truth. And who can complain about that? His book and his teaching goes beyond golf and will have a person realizing his or her full potential in both life and sports. Besides his book, there are more about these at some point after I quit chatting. He has a video series of instructions and talks that are available on YouTube, and I've watched and listened to a number of those. He can tell us more about how we can access some of his things. Noah and I first met about a month ago in central Wisconsin at the Sand Valley Resort. And we played one or two rounds together, I think. And I can tell you, he is an absolutely terrific player and an equally great person. He's a tremendous person to have in your foursome, very friendly, very very supportive of what everybody else is doing in the foursome. I think he very much embodies the principles of peaceful golf that he teaches. I want to get, you know, I am a biographer, as Noah, I think, knows, and some of you that follow the podcast know I write biographies. So I'm always interested in the biographical background, and Noah has a very interesting one, and I want him to comment on it. But I'm just going to try to go through it as quickly as I can as a biographer. He grew up playing golf. He played pretty early. His father was a golfer. His father was a set designer and a stage designer, a prop man and a stage designer on Broadway. And Noah has sort of followed in his footsteps to that, because he's done that and traveled with and done prop preparation and display for a number of Broadway shows. So he's traveled the country and he's traveled the world. He grew up in the New York City area. He still lives in Manhattan, I believe, but he really does travel the world. I want him to talk to us about that. As I said, he played golf, learned golf from his father. He caddied. He played some junior golf tournaments. He left the game for a while, as I guess in his late teens, and then picked it back up and decided to, just out of the blue, decided, well, I'm going to be a golf professional, which he certainly is qualified to do. And but it took him a while to get there. And he had a type of an epiphany after working to get his game to the point where he could become a professional golfer. He had this epiphany about, because he had had lessons from lots of noted golf instructors and self-instruction, of course, as well. But he had this epiphany that he was kind of hitting a wall in terms of how good his play was doing. And he had this idea that he was just thinking about the game in a wrong way. And he had this epiphany, which has led him to his principles of peaceful golf. And that epiphany not only got his game to where it became, but it inspired him to write his book, Peaceful Golf. Somewhere along the route of this, he became a Golf Week course rater. We want to talk to him about that because a lot of our audience are Golf Week raters. As I said, I met him just earlier this year in Wisconsin at Sand Valley. I will also say that I learned from talking to him on the course that he's just such a great player and with a beautiful swing that he was the champion of our Golf Week Scratch Championship, which is we have got a lot of good golfers that are. As I said, he's in France. I want Noah to tell us why he's there. I think he's actually building a place to live in France, but I don't want to give away too much of his private life. So, Noah, what did I get wrong, or what would you like to embellish on?
I think you got everything right. Nice to see you, Jim. Great to join you on the podcast today. And I'm living in France right now for the next few months. I've been spending about 6 months of the year overseas, trying to get a different culture and seeing how golf is played around the world. And seeing how, I was exposed maybe 5 or 6 years ago to some European courses and some pretty remote places, and just seeing the love and the joy for the game made me really question how we approach it in America compared to the rest of the world. And so I just kind of fell in love with this, just traveling and seeing how other people fall in love with the game of golf, because it's pretty amazing what people will go to play golf.
How many different countries have you been to play golf, and where
I'm up to I'm up to 17 countries that I've visited and played in.
And can you tell us something about some of the more remote or exotic or strange places that you've played?
Yeah, one of my favorites, it's only a 9-hole course, but it was in the Faroe Islands. And the Faroe Islands are a little island chain north of Scotland. And they have this little golf course that they literally built by hand. There's about 50 members. And they just found a piece of land there on the island and routed a golf course. And they maintain their own little greens. And it's quite the amazing story. I wrote a blog about it on my website. And I talk about how, there's no golf on the island, as far as no equipment, no way to get balls, anything like that. The closest ball is like a 5-hour boat ride. So to see these people out there on this gloomy day when it's pouring rain, they're playing in galoshes, and they were nice enough to take me in during their club championship. They let me play with them, and talking.
That was a mistake.
Well, I wasn't competing. No, I wasn't competing. I was just there to observe what was going on. And it was just amazing to see this passion for this golf course that literally had no grass. They played on rock and barren soil, and they were just in love with the game. And I was just like, there's such passion out there for this game of golf that we all love. And it doesn't matter what conditions you have a lot of times, like we're fortunate enough with Golf Week to play some really outstanding condition golf courses. But then to see that same passion in this course that you and I wouldn't even give a second look to, just opened my eyes to how much joy this game brings to people.
Well, as a biographer, I strongly believe, I think it's a Wordsworth quote, that the child is the father to the man. And reading the first few chapters of your book, where you do talk, that are autobiographical, and you talk about your growing up with the game and the influence of your father. And then I'm leading to the point of the epiphany. If I were a biographer and I was trying to make sense of your life, which makes a lot of sense, and I had to try to set up an explanation for why the epiphany took place. You know, what leads a person to that? I would think that there was something special in your growing up with the game and your relationship with your father and your relationship with other golfers and friends, and then some type of experience that's self-knowledge on your part, that all of that, without the childhood that you had and the background you had in golf and the type of background you had, the epiphany would not have happened. There's an explanation for it happening to you when it did. Am I wrong about that?
I think it's very, I've looked back at it many times and wondering why it happened. And I keep tracing back to a time, you know, I played early, like I said, early on, 4 years old. My dad wrapped duct tape around a cutoff set of irons to make me clubs. And I was just passionate about the game as a young person, not as passionate as I became, but I definitely enjoyed going and golfing with my father. You know, that strong relationship, that bond of getting to hang out with the male figure in your life definitely was important to me. But it wasn't until I got out of college and I had no direction. I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I was doing some theater stuff, but I really wasn't into it. And my dad took me golfing and we hadn't golfed in years. And he said, "What do you want to do with your life?" And I tell you, Jim, it was like a lightning bolt hit me on the golf course. I don't know why, but it was on the first hole and I'll never forget it. I was standing there and I was just like, it was like God spoke to me and said, "You need to do this." And it was odd because I hadn't shown that much interest in golf other than just enjoying the game. But I knew at that moment that I needed to go and play golf. And from that moment on, I took it as seriously as you could take anything. I mean, it was every part of my life for the last 30 years. So
tell us more about the epiphany, because it's not just an epiphany about wanting to become a golf professional. It's an epiphany about how you can do it.
So that was my introduction into golf, to really start studying golf. And from there, over the next three years, I started reaching out to other instructors and trying to get, because, you know, you realize pretty quickly, like, oh, maybe I can get better if I go and get an instructor to help me. Well, I had the opposite effect on me. I got worse. I just kept hitting dead end after dead end after dead end. And I finally hooked up with a guy that I met named David Lee, the teacher of gravity golf. And I became an instructor of his. And he had his philosophy was, I can turn you into professional in 18 months. So for me, that was my dream. And I trained for the 18 months and I wasn't a professional. So I stuck with it for about 7 years and I just never got there. And I reached a point of frustration with the game because I was doing all the things the instructor asked me to do. I was doing everything I could possibly do. And I was ranked as a top teacher in America by Golf Digest. And I just couldn't break through that wall of, why am I not shooting under par every time? What's going on? And so I got frustrated and I said, I'm done with golf. And I walked away for a couple of months. And a friend of mine said, "Hey, you want to come play with us?" A few months later, said, "You want to come play 9 holes with us?" And I was so frustrated. I said, "You know what? Fine, let's play again." And I went out to the golf course. And on the first tee, I stood there. And it was the first time in my life since I was 4 years old that I didn't have an idea of what I was working on in the golf swing. You know, from a young age, my dad was always saying, turn your hips or do this. Or my instructor was saying, do this. And everyone was always telling you what you needed to work on, including yourself. You're always telling yourself something to work on. And it was at that moment when I realized that I didn't know what I was working on, that the light bulb went off. And I said, well, what would happen if I took a golf swing and I didn't do anything? I didn't think about anything. I just swung the golf club. What would happen? And I knew at that moment I didn't know the answer to that question, because I'd always taken a golf swing with thought, with some kind of direction, with some kind of manipulated movement to make my body move. And I said, well, there's only one way to find out. Let me tee this thing up and take it back and see what happens. And so I teed it up and I stood there for a second and I said, okay, I'm not gonna, whatever happens, however it comes back, that's, I'm going with it. I could shank this, I could miss it, I don't know, but I know I don't know what happens if I swing without thought. And so I couldn't tell you what I did because I wasn't thinking, but I can tell you the result. It was right down the middle, 300 yards. And in that round of golf for 9 holes, I hit 3 flagsticks in the air, boom, 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 3 times. And I was just flabbergasted. I was like, this is blowing my mind right now that I could play this proficiently without directing my body, that my body had all this information already in it. And so then I started to go on the quest of, okay, I got to go share this with a few people because this might be nothing. You know, a lot of times as a golfer, you know, you find something and then 2 weeks later that movement doesn't work anymore. And you say, this wasn't working. But I wanted to just get this out there. And I got this out there to one of my top students. And I wanted to see if he experienced the same thing when he let go and didn't think about anything in his mind and didn't try to make a golf swing in the typical sense. And he was having the same results. And he was qualified 2 weeks later. He qualified for the US Open. And it was just a remarkable experience for the next few months of uncovering what happens when the mind doesn't think about the golf swing and you just swing naturally, your natural, whatever that is. And so then it started to evolve into me questioning other things. Like, well, you know, I started experimenting with this whole process of not being confounded by thinking. And so I would sit down at night and I would draw pictures. I started out with some artwork because it was at night. I couldn't do my golf swing. I said, all right, let me put a piece of paper down. And normally when I would draw, I wasn't a good artist. I would draw like stick figures. I wasn't very good. But this time I said, well, let's do the same thing as golf and let's not sit down with an intention in our mind. Let's just sit down with a blank piece of paper. I'll grab the pencil and whatever comes out. If it's squiggly lines, if it's whatever, but I'm not going to sit there and imagine an apple and draw an apple. And Jim, these pictures started coming out that were just mind blowing. Like they're just incredible, incredible works of art that I was drawing in like quick amount of time, like half an hour, done. And so I started bringing them to my place of work and showing people. And they were like, there's no way you're doing this in a half an hour. I said, sit down and watch. And I would sit down and draw these pictures. And just it started to open my mind to all these possibilities of how thought in our life is a limiting factor. It doesn't allow us to really. Well, you know, that's a question I often ask in my book. I say, what does freedom mean to you? So if we're going to do a lesson for you right now, what does the word freedom mean to you?
Jim? Well, I've listened to your talks, so okay. I know it's not supposed to be simple. You know, conventionally people would say it's what you as a person would choose for yourself. You know, that you choose in this or you choose that, you're free, and that means freedom. And what you're arguing, and I think makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I've studied some Eastern philosophies and so forth, and I think there's some consistencies between that and what you're doing. Is that you're suggesting that what's really freedom is the state of mind and subconscious of not really feeling like you even need to make a choice, that the choices are just sort of there as a range of options for you, and it's not a rational kind of thing. But am I wrong?
No, honestly, that's what everyone always answers the same way. They say to choose what I'd like to do, to, mm-hmm. you know, what I'd like. And I always say, well, the minute you choose, you've given up freedom.
Yeah.
Because the minute you go in one direction, there's no more freedom. Freedom is all encompassing movement in all directions. So that's what I felt like my mind was in a state of. It was in a state of freedom. And it was only in that state for a brief second. But in that brief second, I started to understand what was going on and why my movements in my body were so limited and why I couldn't master this game and why it was so difficult to play golf at a high level. And, you know, you've actually probably heard this, but a lot of golf coaches that I've spoken to, when they teach the higher level golfers, they'll, in confidence, they will tell you, there's not a lot going on between the ears of a lot of these guys. Okay. That's an advantage because they're not dwelling on their shots. They're not thinking golf, they're playing golf. And so when you get in that state, yeah, go ahead.
I want to play a little bit, although I'm so enthralled with your teaching principles that I am very open to them, but let me express a few skeptical things. I mean, sure. Do you think that you came to these ideas and to this inspiration because of who you really are and how you are wired, that in a sense it's a natural outgrowth, as surprising as it turned out to be to you at that time in your life as an epiphany, that you really still were wired in such a way that you could be receptive to this approach? There are maybe millions of other people that are not wired that way, and as hard as they might try, they aren't going to reach that peaceful approach that you're saying. My question was, do you think that in terms of that there are millions of people, and I think I might count myself as one of them, who may just not be wired in a way that will allow us to open up and tap into the subconscious, and that we're too rational, we're too full of thoughts. Our self-talk is always going to be in the way for us. But I think you argue in your teaching that it's open to everybody. It might take some training, it might take some practice. It's almost like trance meditation. You've got on a regular basis before it actually clicks in. So do you think it's available to everybody, or are there some people that just are going to be, are their personality types are just such that they're not going to be able to approach it?
I just think it's the way we've been wired as human beings. You know, we're programmed from a very early age to learn language. Okay. So from a little child's aspect, you know, if you watch a child try to learn anything, let's say walking is a very complex motor skill. But yet we see every kid in the world learns to walk. There's only a few people that never learn to walk, but we don't see very many people crawling anymore, right? So now if you think about it, when these kids were little, when they're 1.5 years old, they don't have language yet. They can't communicate with their parents to get advice from on how to learn this skill of walking. All they're getting is the ability to look and see the adult walking, and then they just figure it out. They're forced to figure it out without anyone else's help. And so when I started seeing that and started realizing that, oh, they're performing this really complex skill without any help at all from anyone, but yet they're figuring, every single human being, smart, intelligent, are people that have low IQs, they figure this out. Well, if you just put a golf ball there and you said, that's what you have to figure out, my feeling is everyone could figure that out too. But the problem comes in when, and you see this a lot with children and learning, you know, as soon as a child in golf starts to show any kind of progress, and the parent, the first thing they do is they say, we got to get an instructor for this kid because he's really talented. And then the first thing the instructor does is if the instructor wants to get paid, he has to do some work. He can't just say, well, just let him develop naturally. He goes in there and he starts saying, well, let's work on this, and let's get the body to move like this, and let's get this to happen. And as soon as that occurs, the learning process that was natural becomes retarded, and you interfere with that natural process, just like the child trying to learn. Imagine if every time a child was trying to learn to walk, you went down and grabbed his legs and was like trying to tell him how to move his legs. You would interfere with the process. So I think what happens is, as we get older, and you know, you say you're very analytical, we've been over years and years and years of learning language and repeating these things in our mind, we've forced ourselves to become analytical. And what I ask the student to do is to start to reawaken that learning process that we all had as a little child. So I don't think anyone's any different. I just think we've covered it up with a lot of learning that has slowed our progress. And so when, you know, a lot of people will say to me, you know, yeah, you figured this out this way because you hit millions of balls up until that point. It was very easy for you to just let go. You had it trained. It's going to be impossible for me as a beginner to do that. And I always explain to them, I said, no, it's actually the opposite. It's much harder for me because I had so many preconceived ideas about what the right swing was from studying mechanics for so long that I had to let go of all my preconceived ideas. A complete beginner is the easiest golfer to teach. They don't know what they're doing. If you set them on the path to learning naturally, they will learn very quickly how to hit that golf ball. What happens is, as soon as you start telling them, hold the club like this, do that, all of a sudden they can't move. They're in this box mentally and physically, and there's no way to grow. So, you know, I liken it to learning a language. I'm actually in the process of learning some French, right? And I'm seeing how difficult this is. And there was some studies done about, you know, just throw yourself in immersion wise and study French where you don't speak anything throughout the day other than French in all your interactions, morning, noon, and night. And in 3 months, you'll be fluent. Now think about that. That takes 3 months to be somewhat fluent. After 3 months of every minute of the day speaking French in your mind, how many people out there are going to go and take a lesson and going to work for 3 months straight with every single thing they do thinking about golf. It's not going to happen. Yeah. So the normal person who learns a language goes and they study for, let's say, 18 months, and they're pretty proficient. But you'll never get that dialect to be exactly as the natural born French person teaches, is taught. So what I say about traditional instruction is, if you go and you try to learn, because all these instructors have different theories about how the golf swing works, and you choose one, you're choosing a new language to learn. And you're never going, let's say we choose the language of Tiger Woods and how to swing like Tiger Woods. You're never going to have the fingerprint of Tiger Woods. You might get close, but it will never be as natural as the natural born speaker. So do you want to be someone who's always struggling to speak that language of the instructor, or would you rather learn what your natural movements are, what your natural ability is, and hone that where it's natural? And what I found is when I swing naturally and don't think about mechanics and don't think about under pressure, there is no, the pressure, I can perform under that because I'm not performing any repetitive task. I'm just swinging. I'm just trusting my body can figure this out and swing. And I know that sounds crazy and people will be like, there's no way that can work, but you can look at my reviews on my book and see that the people I teach in just an hour or two, they come back shooting their best rounds because they're no longer constrained. They're free. The freedom just opens up all the movements of the body and the mind.
Noah, let me take this I would imagine that most of the listeners, if not 99.9% of the listeners, for this podcast, because it goes a lot out to the Raiders, is that they've played golf for a lot of years. I mean, I played golf now for over 60 years. I've got lots of swings in me that already. Now, I'm going to go out later, and you can see my cap on, although the podcast listeners probably can't see anything. But I'm going to go out and have a round today, and I want to try some of these approaches. So I want some specific advice for you. I mean, I've watched some of your videos, but I want to read greens the way you're describing to read greens, instead of, because I always have a problem doing that. And I think what you're suggesting is really good about that. You know, I have problems chipping. You know, I chunk a lot of shots. You saw me play in Sand Valley. You know, I have a hard time finishing my swing sometimes. And I'm always thinking mechanics. I'm thinking mechanics. What am I doing wrong mechanically? I think about bunker shots, your instruction about bunker shots. I think about walking to the first tee. You know, I think about what should I be thinking about? Or shouldn't I be thinking? I mean, what do you have to think about not to be thinking about anything? I mean, how do I get my mind into the place where I can let the subconscious sort of take over and do these wonderful things? I know my foursome for today, and I'm playing with a couple of numbskulls and agitators that it's going to make it hard for me to have any kind of peace on the golf course, let alone, you know, a peaceful journey. I mean, these guys are going to drive me crazy. So how do I handle that? So give me, I assume you deal with a lot of golfers that are veteran golfers, and they've got so many embedded, ingrained habits now, most of them bad. I mean, give me some specific advice that can be applied, not just to me, but to people like me, as to how do I go play around the golf now that I can start to work this out? Okay, or maybe working it out's the wrong phrase. It's not work, it's play, or something else.
Well, we're trying to get that mind in that state of freedom, right? And so we don't want to get there through force. We don't want to get there through forcing the mind to be quiet, because as soon as we do that, we're in a state of resistance and we're not going to be able to learn anything in that state. So the first thing to do is we have to become aware of our preconceived ideas. So you go to the range, the first thing you do is stand over the ball and start to just watch and listen to your mind. See what it's saying. You know it has a pattern saying, okay, take it in. Like the comment you just made, I don't finish my backswing. How do you know where your backswing is? You know where it is because you've told yourself this is where it's supposed to be. So what I'm saying is throw all that out, listen. What I do with my students is I'll say, okay, now this is, we're going to work on letting go. We're going to swing, but I can only help you if you tell me exactly what your mind is saying when you're swinging. So they'll stand over the ball and they'll say, I'm thinking about my grip. And I'll say, okay, so you see how by thinking about your grip, you're not going to be in a state of freedom. You're going to be in a state of control. Now you've already set up the swing for failure the minute you start thinking about anything. And so we just start going through and I start showing them how their mind is not allowing them to swing in freedom. And as soon as people start to see, oh my God, yes, I do that. Yes, I am thinking about that. And, but shouldn't I be doing this? And I say, well, what you should be doing is being in a state of freedom. You know, everyone says, but aren't there fundamentals? I say, no, there are no fundamentals, because look, I can just show you at the highest levels of golf, some people have a strong grip, some people have a weak grip, some people have a neutral grip. They all have, there's players that play with reverse grips and win on the PGA Tour. Okay, so they're, let the fundamentals go out the window. That's one of the biggest misconceptions about movement. There are no fundamentals. I think you saw in my book, I talk about Bob Fosbury and the Fosbury flop over the high bar, right? Everyone used to jump forward. This guy jumped forward. He said, I can't beat these guys doing this. I got to figure something out. He learned to jump backwards, and all of a sudden he changed the entire sport. Now everyone jumps over backward, and they're like 2 or 3 feet higher than they've ever been. So the minute we constrain ourselves to saying, well, this is what the best players do now, we're not allowing our mind to operate in freedom and really get to that place of creative learning. You know, when you talk about the putting. So when we get on the putting green, you have to realize this mind is the greatest computer. It can analyze and dissect so much stuff. But the minute we as individuals take the conscious mind and say, I'm going to think about, you know, like many golfers will go out there and say, all right, there's wind, it's uphill, it's cold out, it's this, it's that. And they'll go through this checklist of things before they pick their club selection. Well, I've played entire rounds of golf where I never let the mind wander once to think about that. What I realized was if I just stood there behind the golf ball in the first tee and just let my mind look at the hole, not analyze the hole, not say those things, but just be quiet and be completely present while I gazed at the scenery in front of me, meaning the hole, I could see the flag, I could see everything, but I wasn't saying, oh, it's on the left, oh, it's here, oh, I got to hit that. That all stopped and I just looked. And when I looked and walked back to the golf bag, my eyes would just lock on a club. And I would pull that club, and there was many times, I mean, I'd be 140 yards out, and my mind would go and pull a 4-iron. And I'd say, what is going on? Why am I looking? Why am I like laser focused on this 4-iron after just staring at that situation? And I would take the 4-iron out. I'd say, okay, I trust it. I trust this process of creative learning. Let's just see what happens. And that's really the main question you have to constantly ask yourself. What would happen if? Meaning, if I let go, what happens? And so there I am with the 4-iron from 140 yards, a club I've never practiced, a shot I've never practiced. And all of a sudden I hit this little like chip shot almost, and the ball runs up and comes 2 inches away from the hole. And I'm saying, I would have never thought that would be possible. Like, it just makes you realize there's so much more to the game than the way we traditionally think about it. It can be played in so many different ways once the mind becomes free. And so my teaching is really about not teaching you mechanics, but giving you specific things like tasks to perform. So in a sense of like, okay, I want to see you hit a fade and then a draw. I think one of the best ways to teach someone how to learn and to get them in good movement positions is to have them be able to hit draws and fades. Well, you're going to get up there and say, well, what do I do to hit a fade? And I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to watch your brain when your mind is free and you tell it something. You tell it what to do, just like the little kid when he's learning was telling his body to get up and walk like his parents. But remember, he didn't have any language, so he wasn't talking to himself. When the mind was quiet, he was able, after a bunch of tries, to get up and walk across the room to his parents. And the same thing, when you tell the mind, when you give it a directive and say, I want to see that shape, I want to see that ball move in that direction, and you don't know how to do it, your mind will figure it out. And it doesn't take long at all. It's mind-blowing when you see it happen for the first time.
May I share a story briefly?
Sure.
As briefly as I can, that tell me whether or not this was an experience. I mean, I think, you know, if you've played golf, you have some kind of, I don't know, there are some spiritual experiences of sorts. I'm not talking necessarily in a religious sense, but I was writing my Robert Trent Jones Sr. biography. I was at Cornell University campus in the archives working for a few weeks, a summer, you know, 10 years ago. And late in the evening, after a rain shower, you know, I thought, well, I'll go out and play a few holes at the Cornell University course, which Jones designed back in the 30s. And I, when I went out there, I was like the only one there because it really had just stopped raining. It was still kind of drizzling. So when I got out on the course, and I'm deeply immersed in Robert John Jones' papers. I mean, his life, everything about him. And so when I got on the course, and this is a course he designed, I just had this feeling that he was with me. I don't really mean it. I mean it metaphorically, not really physically, but I had this real sense of, so I started talking to him. I mean, in my head, I started talking to Jones about his course and about playing shots. And I got to this one par five. I was like even par after six or seven holes. And I got to this par five that he hit out through a chute and it cuts right. And when I'm playing fairly well, I usually draw the ball. I hook the ball and I don't have the left or right shot very well. And I was thinking, well, okay, Jones, he's telling me I need to hit a cut, a little bit of a fake through this chute of trees. And he said, aim at the tower. You know, there's something at the university, you know, aim at this tower out here, you'll be perfect. And I got over the ball and I thought, well, yeah, that's what I'll do. And I wasn't thinking mechanics at all. I was just thinking, well, Jones is telling me to hit it here and hit it with the cut. And darn it, if I didn't hit it exactly where he told me to hit it. And so I played the entire round in my head, and I wasn't thinking, I mean, I was thinking about things, but I was thinking about what he was would say to me. And so it was like this, just this almost.
You were playing golf, not thinking golf.
I was.
And as soon as that subconscious can take over like that, and that's, you know, there's a lot of tricks that you've heard a lot of psychologists say where, all right, we're going to think about something else, or we're going to hum a tune while we're trying to play, so we stop thinking about this movement pattern. And so those little tips, those little tricks can work, but I found that getting in that state of a quiet mind, as opposed to trying to put something in the mind to take the distraction off, really allows you to learn and see how subtle that mind is tricking you a lot of the times, because we've been brought up to be analytical. You know, the mind is great for building things like cars and computers, but for physical movements, it's one of the biggest limiters in our ability to really move at a high level.
These special experiences I've had, I only tell you that one, but I've had a few others that are comparable. You know, they seem to happen when I'm playing alone, you know, and when I don't have the, you know, I'll call it noise, when I don't have the noise of the other players, or I'm not playing, and I'm not playing competitively anyway. We're not playing skins, and we're not, you know, playing, you know, two downs and stuff like that. When I'm in those events with other players, like I said before, numbskulls and agitators off, you know, it's hard to be in this peaceful place. You know, how do you do that when you're in a foursome with other people?
And that's what I was going to tell you today. You know, you said you're going out to play. I'm like, you know, if you're trying to learn something new, let's say you're trying to learn how to drive for the first time and you've got your four buddies in the car and they're joking with you and picking on you the whole time, you're not going to be able to learn how to drive a car. Like, that's not the place to start out doing something. You know, the place to start out is spend a little time on the range and learn to, like I said, watch your mind and see what it's saying. You know, though, you develop any skill over a period of time. It doesn't just happen instantaneously in the sense that you're going to get better. The reason I had an instantaneous improvement was I had worked at it for 10 years. Okay. The beginner or even yourself, you have a ton of skill, but until that mind becomes quiet, you're not going to you have to train the mind, teach it, learn how to have that mind become quiet. And once it does, here's another thing that I found happens to most golfers. Most golfers, when they discover this, the first thing that happens is they start hitting some really bad shots. And you're like, well, what's going on? I'm going to tell you what's going on. The minute you get into a state of freedom, the mind now says, wow, you've given me the keys to this Ferrari. Let's see what it can do. And you start swinging in all new positions that your mind has never been able to go to before, because you've always been telling it, keep the elbow down, turn the hips. Now all of a sudden it's like, man, I've got all this range of motion, and it has to sort out the movements. So for the first 20 or 30 swings, it's just trying to reorientate like what it's capable of doing. That's a very scary feeling for most players, to be able to, you know, have the arm fly out for some people, or some people it'll stay tucked. They're positions they've never been in before and they feel very unnatural. But as you'll see, if you just give it a few minutes, a few swings, you'll start to see that the brain will say, Oh, I see. If I go out there, I can't make contact. If I go in here, I can make contact. This isn't conscious. It's just figuring out this process. And then after 20, 30 swings, you're just repeating the shots over and over and over again.
But isn't this a truth? I mean, we talk, your book talks about truth, and you talk in your instruction about truths. Isn't it a truth of a different sort that you can't have peaceful golf and not have a peaceful approach in every other aspect of your life, or at least in most of them? I mean, if you don't have a peaceful life, you can't approach it that way, you know, in everyday life, in everyday circumstances, in your relationships, you know, in your family, with your marriage, whatever. If you can't do it there, what's your chances of doing it in on the golf course? I mean, maybe there's some chance. It seems it's an
It's
integrated package.
pretty clear to see from my experience that my outward state is a reflection of my inner state. So when there's chaos in my outer life, it generally means there's chaos inside of my mind. And so we can see that when it comes to golfers, right? There was a period there where Tiger Woods was hurt and he was going through all of his personal problems. And you saw he was literally, I remember watching a shot where he was at Torrey Pines and he was trying to come back and he was literally duffing shots. This is the greatest player in the world and he's duffing shots. Well, that's you once late years go by, you start to realize, man, his inner state was a mess at that point. He couldn't perform outwardly. So exactly. I mean, I can always see when my tournaments are my best, when my inner state, meaning my entire life inwardly is going well, my outward life is easy. You know, people always talk about is it what's the hardest round you ever played? Like, is it, you know, when you shoot in the low 60s? I'm like, no, those are the easy rounds.
Absolutely.
That's when golf is easy. Because it just was working. It was just peaceful. There was nothing to work on. I wasn't trying to make it go in the hole. It just seemed like it was like a magnet to the hole. And so, yes, I completely see that as a truth that the inward state is a reflection of your outward state. And so when you're having a tough time in life outwardly, if things aren't going well outwardly, you're getting pulled over by the police or you're having this problem or that problem. Just take a look inwardly and see if you're in that same state. And I've always found that I am. And that's a big wake-up call to say. And like I said, you know, the biggest problem I think people don't realize in life is that thought being useful in certain areas has dominated our culture to where our mind is on constant go. And that's what you've seen so many of these great Eastern philosophers talk about. It's like, we got to quiet that down. You know, it's great for some things, but we can't have the brain on 24 hours a day. It's got to have moments for a break, because in the break is where the real learning is achieved.
Well, I think unfortunately, my circumstance of a lot of times is, you know, I'll have even my golfing friends, and certainly my wife will tell me, "Look, Jim, it's all in your head." I mean, the problem is all in your head, and I'll tell my response back is, "Well, that's the worst place for it to be," you know. So, how do I handle that? So, I mean, I think for me, it's going to be the journey to peaceful golf is I mean, I don't have that many more years to find it, but I have found it from time to time. And when you find it, it is sublime. It is
Oh.
really incredible. I can think of a few rounds in my life where I've had exactly what you are describing. But unfortunately, they must just come at certain moments in my life when things are, you know, that things are more tranquil, and I am not in my head so much,
Well,
and I
think
need.
about what happened. Think about what happens when you have that
Yeah.
experience. When you have that experience, what's the next thing the mind says after you've had that experience? It says, I want that again.
I want it again.
And so as soon as that desire, I mean, that thought comes in and says, I want that again, and you try to capture that, it's like trying to hold on to air. You can't hold on to it. Like, you're just going to keep grasping and it's just going to keep going through your fingers.
Yeah, tell us, you know, you have some important points to make about change and being accepting of change, that things, especially in a golf game. I mean, how many times have we heard, you know, or said to ourselves, I mean, I did this last week. I shot 36 on the front nine on a tough front nine, and then the ne next day I came out and I was thinking, what I shoot 45 on the same nine? What happened? You know, I thought that it was the same thing. Well, something's changed overnight, you know,
Well,
and
we know the one constant in life it's the only truth that I see as a real truth is that nothing is permanent. Everything is in a state of change, because the present moment is turning into the next present moment, and that moment is always in a state of flux. You know, every day you might not notice it. You might think it's the same day as yesterday, but the air pressure's changed. Whatever you ate for dinner has made your body physically change. You might get a little bit tired on that back nine. You're in a constant state of change. So even though we go out there and we try to make the same repetitive motion with the golf swing, it's never going to be the same as it was yesterday. And so when you have a swing where you're free and you don't think about where it goes at all, then you're always making the slight adjustments to make the new swing be fresh and alive and free. But no one's doing that. We're all going out there and trying to make the same swing we made yesterday. Well, yesterday it was 80 degrees, today it's 60, and that pressure change makes my muscles a little tighter and I can't make the same move. So it's much better to be in a state of acceptance and flexibility than this rigid, this is the way it works. And it's just, change is the biggest. It's learning to accept that golf is going to have its ups and downs is the greatest part of the game. You know, those times I go out there and I'm so frustrated that I'm shooting a poor round. You know, the day after I played with you at Sand Valley, I went out with another group of the guys and we played Sand Valley, not Mammoth. And I started out and I was 7 over par on the front nine. Yes, I was. It was brutal. But you know what it was? It was early in the morning. I don't like to play early in the morning. We made the turn. I go out, I go up, I get a breakfast sandwich, I come back down, and I shoot 5 under on the back nine.
There you go. That's more than.
And these guys were like, "What just happened?" I said, "That's part of acceptance." I go, "You saw I wasn't frustrated with I was having a good time with you guys. I was more in shock that I was shooting 7 over on the front because I just played so great the day before with you." But then, just like that, the game can change. I mean, literally, in just from 1-9 to the next, what happened to you? The same exact thing. It was 1-9 to the next. It's, are you letting that defeat you, or are you starting to say, "Okay, today is not my day. Let me enjoy my surroundings. Let me take pictures of this beautiful golf course. Let me get involved with my friend who might need some help right here. Let me get out of golf because this is not where I need to be right now. I need to be." I'm here for another reason. It's not to shoot a good score today. And as soon as you start letting go, the other day I just played a French professional here and he's wanted to beat me ever since we started playing. He's never beaten me. And so I just got back here and he said, "I'm going to beat you today. I'm going to punch you in the nose. I'm going to beat you. I'm going to beat you." I said, "Okay." And that's his terminology. I said, okay, great. And we went to a course I'd never played before. And I wasn't concerned about it. It was my first round. I took a month off of golf, so it was my first round back. And I was just enjoying the day, seeing my friend again, and just having fun. And by the 12th hole, the match was over. And I realized by looking at him, he was getting so angry. And I said, "Boy, that was some round." I said, "I never once thought about beating him. But I see that that's all he was thinking about." Yeah. And it's amazing how the two golfers reacted totally differently with their movements and their ability to play golf at a higher level. Him trying to perform at a high level never allowed it to happen. Me just playing, not trying to do anything other than just play and have a good time, allowed me to perform my highest level. And so that's what I would say to you is just go out there today and have fun. You know, that's why we play the game. I play to have fun.
Find a holistic value in what you're doing, you know, and embrace change, embrace failure, and don't see it as failure. It's just part of the journey, and the journey's worthwhile, just like everything else about our life is. So, Noah, thank you so much. I'd like to do this again. I'd like to continue.
I'd love to.
This because, you know, therapy sessions, you need to be in therapy over and over again in order for it to really succeed. So this has been a great therapy session for me. You know, my son is a psychiatrist, but I tried to get him to play golf, but I think I probably took the wrong approach that we were talking about earlier. And so he decided when he was a mid-teen, he's not playing golf. It's too hard. And you know, that maybe golf led him into psychiatry at some point. I don't know. But anyway, but I really enjoyed this. There's so much more we can talk about. I hope our paths cross again soon. Enjoy your learning of the French language and playing. Have you played a course in X called Prince de Provence? It's also known as Vitaban. I wrote about it in my Jones book because he built it in the 90s, and his son Rob Trent Jones Jr. ended up finishing the course. And it's kind of open and kind of not open for play, but you could get on, I'm sure.
So that's an interesting story. So it's actually not in X. It's in a town called Vitaban.
Okay.
Which is about an hour from X. And I have played. I've played it twice, believe it or not. And an interesting story about that is when I played the first time, I met the CEO of the club. It's an interesting story. There's only like 8 members of the whole club. It's one of the most exclusive clubs in the world. And I was fortunate enough to get on there by having Armand write a letter for me from Golf Week to the CEO to let me come and play. They really didn't want a rating. They weren't interested. Mm-hmm. But I was able to play. And after I met the CEO and talked to him for a while and just discussing golf stories and everything, he goes, you know, I have a book for you I want you to read. And he gave me your book, and you actually signed it to him. So I actually have that book in my house. And that's why when I first met you, I was so excited to meet you, because I'd read this book and I said, this guy is the greatest writer and I love his golf stories. And so, yes, I have played that course. It's an amazing coincidence, actually.
Do you consider it? I mean, and some people have said and even written that it's one of Europe's great golf courses.
If you go on my website, peacefulgolf.com, I have a whole blog and all the pictures of the course. It's truly incredible golf course. It's one of Jones's best designs, in my opinion. It's set in these parasol pines, and it's in nature. There's no one else there. The cicadas are like, it's like a festival of music out there. And some of the design, the holes are just perfect risk reward strategy holes. And it's phenomenal. And the conditioning is really spectacular. If you're a big fan of conditioned golf courses, you know, he was telling me that they try to have a contest every year with Augusta to see who has better conditions.
My God,
that's the kind of conditioning.
Do you think that they would consider having a Golf Week retreat there?
No, they are.
They probably wouldn't, right?
No, they don't want anyone going there. Literally, he told me there was like 300 rounds a year. That was it. No one plays it. It's, you walk on the tee and you can see that you're the only divot that's been there for weeks. And you're like, this is insane.
Well, you know, I did not go there, but I had all the papers about Vitaban were in the Jones papers, which are at Cornell University Archives. But I had a student at the time, Justin Melnick, who is now a Golf Week reader and now he just got married. He lives in Denver, I believe. He's probably, you know, he graduated from Auburn University maybe 10, 12 years ago. And we arranged for him to actually to go to Vitaban and to play it and to interview the manager. And I think there was a woman that was involved in the either the management or the ownership of the course that he talked to as well. So it's a fascinating story because Jones almost went bankrupt as a result of building that development. He had big ideas. And besides being the architect, he wanted to be the developer. And he got into trying to get through the French system of developing and owning and developing land. You know, there were bribes to pay. There were all kinds of civil service regulations and stuff that had to be done. And it almost cost him his entire bankroll. So it's got a really interesting history that I try to cover in the book. I'm glad that you were able to slay it, and I'll have to go try to do that myself at some point.
Yes, it has to be on your list for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Noah, thank you so much, and we will have to do this again.
Jim, I would love to. Thanks for having me on, and love playing golf with you out in Sand Valley, and hopefully we can play again.
And where can people get your book?
My book is on my website, peacefulgolf.com. There's a link to Amazon. I have a Kindle and I also have a hard copy on there as well. And I'm working on the audio version of it, believe it or not. I'm trying to get that finished up. I'm about halfway through my recording on that. And cause a lot of people like to listen in the car, you know, you read the book. It's a quick read. It's very, very authentic in its presentation.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think everyone will enjoy it.
Have a good time in France, and we'll see you back in America soon, hopefully.
Thanks, Jim. Take care.
Bye. Peace. Bye-bye.